intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
Fifth grade. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, hello everyone. Here we are on the last day of April in the year of 2021, and you are tuned in to the Rebel Madman and his wonderful producer, Dave Scorpio, and our very informed and intellectual guest, Cal Robbins. And we are here today, as we usually are on this time frame, to speak to the process, or, you know, one of the things that has always troubled me, and that is, well, I said always, but recently has troubled me in the past 10 so years, is the constant use of the word, well, our founders, our founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, they said this and they did that. And, you know, our founding fathers would be so disappointed at this, and our founding fathers intended that. And we hear this over and over again. And one of the things that I have enjoyed lately, to my own perverse amusement, is to actually pin people down and say, okay, which founding father are you referencing? Because they were different. And then I have asked people, how many of these founding fathers can you name? And where were they from? And what were their political background? And when they got to the Constitutional Convention, who do you believe that they were there to represent? And just to be totally candid, the ignorance of America is absolutely astounding when you start asking for particulars about founding fathers. And ask people, well, of these, how many founding fathers do you know who attended the Constitutional Convention? And that's always a good question. But these same people, being ignorant of so many details, will be the first to jump on the bandwagon and tell you how wrong you are when you interject facts from actual historical source documents. And that is one of the things that has just been absolutely, you know, really eye-opening to me over the past decade or so. So anyway, check in with our good producer, Dave Scorpio from down south of the equator. How are you doing today, Dave?
I'm still alive, Mike. I'm doing okay. How are you?
Doing great up here in Iowa for a week or so, and enjoying time with my son and his family. And Cal, how are you doing out there in sunny Arizona, my friend?
I'm doing good out here. Thanks for asking, Mike. It's supposed to hit 100 degrees today, so we're going to hit the century mark. We hit it on the first, and I guess now we're going to hit it on the last day of the month.
Oh, wow. Something that piqued my curiosity in a radio program yesterday on Eurofolk Radio. And there was a pretty good discussion on what is going on in Maricopa County as to the exposing the election fraud. Are you familiar with that in any detail whatsoever, Cal?
I haven't been following it much. I know that the Republican Senate wanted a forensic audit of the ballots. So they're spending like, $300,000 of taxpayer money to hire some firm to go back through and count the ballots once again.
Well, I heard that, and I also heard that the Democratic Party has sent probably a legion of attorneys down there to try to stop it, which you know, is very telling in my mind. If I knew that I had an honest election, I wouldn't care how forensic you got with the results. I would only start sending attorneys to try to stop the count if I knew it was fraud. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this election was just an obvious fraud. My thoughts on it is all the elections are a fraud in their basic premise to begin with anyway. The powers that be are going to place into the most important places they need power the people they want. And there's not really anything that anybody can do about it. As just witnessed by what this last election has shown and how people can still support a system which they know is obviously corrupt, blatantly corrupt, but yet here they are still supporting the same corrupt system. It baffles my mind.
Well, Mike, I thought this was all about transparency. I thought we were going to have a transparent government there with old Groper Joe. I'm surprised they haven't accused the people trying to do the recount of being white supremacists or domestic terrorists. You know, in California, with the recall vote, Gavin Newsom is claiming that the recall effort is being led by white supremacists, Mike.
Well, I'm sure. Well, look what they did to Georgia. I mean, Georgia wants an honest election, and look what happened to the people there. I mean, you know, as far as I think the most telling thing, and I say this tongue in cheek, I think the most telling thing was that the devil actually removed the fiddle contest from Georgia because of the election legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's pretty suspicious that black communist guy got elected. And I don't know. The whole thing is just stinks to high heaven, Mike. I think election fraud is absolutely endemic in the system now. And the Democrats plan on solidifying it and making it permanent with new legislation, I believe.
Well, I agree totally. And I believe, as Cal pointed out very well, I believe that this was the powers that be, the deep state, the shadow government, whoever you want to call them. I call them the international bankers. But they wanted this time to, you know, when you are opposing an enemy and they consider the people who really want an honest and fair government or an honest and fair society, they really oppose them and they think they're their greatest threat. Well, sometimes, you know, it's not enough to just defeat your enemy. sometimes you have to rub their nose in it. And I believe that the 2020 election, and I'm certainly no Donald Trump fan, I don't want people to think I'm coming at it from that aspect, but I believe that the 2020 election was a nana nana boo boo, here in your face, what can you do about it? That is my thoughts. What do you guys think about that?
Oh, absolutely. I think what we have is essentially a coup. And, you know, Biden's been saying that America is back on track. Well, it's true. Any part of the plan that Trump may have derailed, you know, I'm no fan of his either. But that's all going to be fixed. And we're going to go back on full speed ahead towards climate change agenda, permanent mask wearing, and the government taking over every aspect of the economy.
Well, I totally agree. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Dave, I think I've mentioned it to you that I believe that as this plandemic, as it begins to wear off, as the people begin to see through the fraud of this entire thing, even to the people who are saying seeing through the fraud of the vaccinations, I believe that what they have, they always have plan B, plan C, and plan D. And I believe the very next thing they're going to hit us with is climate change. And I believe Biden shutting down the pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline, I believe that sometime mid to late summer, we're going to see gasoline shortages, astronomical gasoline prices, and the fake shortages to come about because of the Keystone shutdown. Cal, you have any thoughts on that?
I don't see it as a Democrat-Republican thing. They're both in on it. They're both just – both parties are puppets for the powers that be, or the banksters, as you say. Yeah, and you know, as far as a fuel shortage, yeah, that's orchestrated as well. I mean, the Keystone Pipeline hasn't been completed. They've just stopped working on it. So, you know, there was no oil flowing through it to begin with anyway. So it hasn't gone into effect in relation to what the supply of the supply and demand is. So this is orchestrated. All of it is orchestrated. The pandemic, the fuel shortages, the cost in wood, it's planned.
Here was something I found out, and some very good friends in Idaho pointed this out. I was on a program earlier, and they pointed it out. I didn't get a chance to bring it up on the show, but were you guys aware that the importation of lumber from Canada was canceled or stopped because of COVID?
Oh, wow. That's interesting. It makes sense, though. You know, those little spiky red balls might be on the wood, and we can't risk that.
Yeah. You know, they use these things, and good old Bubus Americanus will accept anything if his politician told him it was true. And Cal, you brought up such a great point about it not being Democrat or Republican, but we have to have, for Bubus, we have to have the illusion that we have opposing parties, that there are actually some who don't want to do this, some who want to do that. If we actually accepted the fact that they are both with the same government, they both bring about the same oppression, the same injustice, the same tyranny, the same despotism. If we ever realized that that was that both parties are participating in that and accepted it, then the people might say, well, hey, we got to do something about this. But as long as they believe they have an adversary, that there's an adversarial relationship in government, they believe they have a chance. And we go back to that wonderful hopium issue.
And controlled opposition.
Yes, yes. And we've got to make sure, and Cal, that was so brilliant that you brought up a couple of weeks ago, if you want to control the opposition, you have to lead the opposition, and they do that so very well. And that is a price, you know, peace resistance of the two-party system.
Well, they have to give the illusion that we have a functional system. I totally agree with that because we don't. But, you know, obviously the money powers fund both sides and they use them as needed.
Okay. Yeah, I agree totally.
Mike,
yes, sir.
You pointed out once that if people couldn't vote, they would see this government for the criminal enterprise that it actually is.
Exactly. And I remember I got a very good friend who was on talk radio in Salt Lake City for years until the Mormons decided he was being too honest. And they kind of took him off the air. But he and I were talking about this on a show out of Salt Lake City about 10 or 12 years ago. And we just absolutely created a violent, not violent, I shouldn't use that phrase. We created a virulent response from the listeners when I said on the air on his talk radio show that voting was a pacifier that they gave the American people to suck on while they robbed them blind. And there was opposition. There were people calling in and telling me I was an infidel. I was, you know, I had to be a liberal because I had said something like that. that I was a liberal. I was this. As long as they have a name, they can call you. What the hell would happen if the people who don't want to hear the truth, what if they didn't have any labels to put on us? How would they respond?
Yeah. And Mike, you know, your observation about, you know, voting is what prevents people from seeing this government as a criminal enterprise. That is a really profound observation. And it's something to really take some time to sit back and ponder, because what we are dealing with is a criminal operation, and voting is the big cover to make it look like we have some kind of input into what happens when we don't.
Exactly. And I wrote an article about 22 years ago, guys, where I said that the sometime in future history, if this world survives, at some time in history, people will look back on the United States government as the most criminal enterprise in the history of the planet. And I truly believe that is the absolute fact, because it is corruption from top to bottom. And it is corruption from your local city, county level, all the way to the central government of the United States. It thrives on corruption. It runs on corruption. Without corruption, the government would collapse upon itself.
Mike, one way to look at it would be to say that the government is the money laundering scheme for the banksters.
Absolutely.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah, great analogy. That is exactly true. We are just laundering the money for them. We go back to what William Paterson said when he created the Bank of England, 1694, 96, whatever year it was. And when he said this is going to be a fantastic enterprise because we will realize the profits of the money we create out of nothing. And, you know, in the commercial market, what if you could sell an illusion and you had a great marketplace and you could force the people to buy your product and your product was nothing but an illusion? How wealthy could you become?
It's infinite, really.
Exactly. There's no end to it. And that is why throughout the history, and when you look at what happened with the Constitution of 1787, that was because the Bank of North America had been voted down and the people in 1785-86 had said, we don't want this anymore. It's destroying us. We don't want the Bank of North America. The Federalists at the Constitutional Convention wanted to make sure that they created a government where they could reinstitute that same bank just by giving it another name. And of course, it went with the First Bank of the United States. And now it's the same exact entity we have now called the Federal Reserve.
They're just the money changers.
Exactly.
Didn't some ancient guy once chase a bunch of money changers out of a temple?
Yeah, I think he did. And I think he had, if I remember correctly, didn't he have a, something like a cat of nine tails or something? He had some kind of whip when he did it.
Yeah, isn't there a lesson there to be learned about what to do with banksters?
Well, you know, recently I had someone tell me on Facebook that Jesus was nonviolent. And when I brought up the money changers thing, they said, "Oh well, everybody does that, but it's not true." Okay, you know, how do you? I am absolutely amazed at the people of all ilk who can just mentally make a fact untrue. They offer nothing to support it, but it's not true.
Well, yeah, and it's a good example of how, you know, Christianity has really been castrated essentially by, you know, I think the biggest cause is the 501c3 tax exemption status they give churches. But yeah, Jesus was a warrior in many ways, and that's the only time I believe he completely lost his temper in the entire book.
Well, didn't he tell his apostles to arm themselves with swords? Or did I misinterpret something?
That would be a lesson in self-defense.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, yeah. You know,
because it's a natural right.
Well, kind of, yeah. And it's granted to us by our Creator. And naturally, we have to let an entity called government overrule anything that God says. Because, you know, they are so benevolent and so kind. So that you're exactly right, Dave, about that. And I wrote an article about that. Wow. 20 years ago, I guess, called "The Black Regiment is Missing." And that and how the churches have been co-opted. And I brought in quite a bit of evidence, including scripture in that, especially Jeremiah 50, chapter 50, verse 6. But to try to jump back to our original theme of our program, I have a question for both you gentlemen. And I'll ask Dave first because I know Cal's answer before I get to it. But if you looked at the founders, the framers, the founding fathers, Dave, who would you consider to be your favorite? And why?
Well, that's a difficult question. You know, I mean, the people that, by founder, you mean the people that signed the Constitution or?
No, just one that you yourself consider to be a founder of the country. During that founding era, not necessarily at the convention, but just someone during the founding era that contributed or worked hard toward the creation of our government, who would your favorite be and why?
Well, it would have to be one of the anti-federalists, probably Patrick Henry. Just because as a group, they all saw what was coming. They all realized that the fix was in and that this was a massive scam run by the bankers that was being played on the American people. And it resulted, they knew that it was going to result in a tremendous loss of freedom. But of course, it's been sold all the way to today as this wonderful benevolent force. So I would have to go with Patrick Henry just because of his bravery and his ability. His writing is just amazing.
His oratory at the Virginia Ratification Convention is just overwhelming, and we may have a unanimous panel here. Cal, who would be your favorite founder?
I would say Patrick Henry, but that would be because he worked hard to not create this federal government. He worked hard not to have this Constitution. He worked hard not to have this centralization of power.
Well, Cal, why aren't we taught that?
Well, that would well, because then people might not be so in love with their government for some unknown reason. I mean, most people support this government because that's just what they've been trained to do. They don't really stop and look at what's going on. Even though they're suffering under the yoke of tyranny, they're still supporting the tyranny. I don't get it, but that's boobus.
Well, you know, we've got these wonderful charlatans out there making money hand over fist with their lies, one of whom is David Barton, who is very popular in the Christian community. And David has just talked about the wonderful Christian nature of Patrick Henry. You know, he was a founder, therefore our founders were Christians and all of this other stuff. And he just studiously avoids Patrick Henry's adamant opposition to the Constitution. Somehow that gets left out in his lessons. You know, does he just not research that deep, or what do you see there?
He's using name recognition. Everybody knows who Patrick Henry is through his "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. So if you can invoke his name, well, then you can pretty much sell anything you want. Just the Federalists used George Washington to sell the Constitution.
That's, exactly.
Well, I bet most people don't even know that Patrick Henry was an anti-Federalist.
Most don't. Most don't. A lot of people pushing the Constitution constantly quote Patrick Henry, which it's like, guys, he was against the Constitution.
Yes, exactly. And also, the one thing I found unusual in all of my studies, and very telling over 35, you know, going on 40 years now, was the fact that of all of the writings of all and or speeches of all of those we call founders, Patrick Henry was the only person that I ever saw who described himself as the representative of liberty for the people. He said, "It is my job to protect their liberty, the liberty of the people." I can't find in all of the Federalist Papers where any of those people or their supporters, the people we call Federalists, where any of them said that their purpose was to defend the rights of the people. Are you aware of anyone else ever approaching that, Cal?
No. Usually when you read the letters of the Federalists, you actually find they're saying just the exact opposite. They wanted to make the state submissive. They wanted to tax the people. They weren't concerned about the liberty of the people. They weren't concerned about state constitutions. This is all in the letters written between the Federalists, who wrote letters to each other in their conspiracy to create this Constitution.
Aha, now you hit upon something that is that most people are totally unaware of, is the number, the thousands of letters that went back and forth between these people during the founding era. And, you know, in today's world, it might be hard to get boobas to understand that they didn't have a cell phone. They didn't have an iPad. They didn't have email. And they didn't have broadcast media except for a newspaper. So how did these people communicate? And they communicated through personal letters. And I was talking with a gentleman in South Dakota about the letters that went between Thomas Jefferson and James Monroe for, you know, well over two decades. And many of their letters were written in cipher. Well, why did Jefferson and Monroe feel like what they were discussing needed to be done in secret? And these letters in cipher occurred while Jefferson was president, and when he was writing to Monroe, and when Monroe, you know, was then Secretary of State under James Madison, the letters that he wrote to Jefferson when Jefferson was out of office that were in what they both referred to as cipher. So they felt a need back then to keep what they were speaking about, to keep that from the public in general. And it was, ironically, it was not for nefarious reasons, for sure. But those letters, Cal, as you mentioned, those letters contain the history. And I remember a college professor who told me, he said, when you read a history book, he said, you read one man's opinion. And he was the first one to tell me about the federal grants that were given to colleges and to history departments at various universities. And shortly after they would get these grants, these large grants, someone on the history faculty would publish a book supporting the government's lies. Were you ever aware of that in any way, Cal?
I became aware of it a few years ago. I knew that the government had paid faculty at the universities to rewrite history. That's just obvious because of reading even a history book from, say, around the turn of the 20th century as compared to now. They're almost opposite of what they're saying. So something had to happen for those history books to change. Ergo, here comes the government, and the common denominator behind all problems, the government.
Well, one of the things I found very interesting, and it started back in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, when I found out how many of these professors were what we would refer to today as card-carrying communists. And one of them, who is considered the end-all, do-all of Civil War historians, Eric Foner, F-O-N-E-R, is a proud professing communist. And he wrote in the late 80s about how terribly upset he was with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and how, you know, that instead of trying to tear the Soviet Union down, the American government should have been trying to support it and to keep it in place. And he's a very proud Marxist. And then we have people like, Clinton Rossiter, who wrote that Abraham Lincoln had to destroy the Constitution in order to preserve it. And what kind of idiot does it take?
Mike, if you look at it, the American government did a lot to keep the Soviet Union going for many years.
True.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible if you look at the amount of help we actually gave them over the years. A lot of this Cold War stuff was just a charade.
Exactly, and all the loans we made Russia that have never been repaid. And, the interest on that ought to be invaluable towards going toward the national debt. Or maybe we could send out stimulus checks. Who knows? So we have these, so you guys are in consent that your favorite founder, or the founder you respect most, was Patrick Henry. Is that correct?
I would say so.
Yeah.
Well, one of the guys, and of course, I am just absolutely a huge fan of Patrick Henry, and that should be obvious. But there are several others, and some of the ones that just absolutely I find intriguing are the ones that we didn't know who they were. You know, who wrote under pseudonyms, and we didn't know who they were. And one of them wrote an article, and I loved it because it was pure satire. I mean, or caustic criticism, if you want to. But his first paragraph just absolutely is telling. And through his cynicism, he told the truth. And here is the first paragraph that he wrote about the Constitution. And he said, "We, the aristocratic party of the United States, lamenting the many inconveniences to which the late Confederation," talking about the Articles, "subjected the well-born, the better kind of people, bringing them down to the level of the rabble and holding in utter detestation that frontispiece to every Bill of Rights, that all men are born equal. We beg leave for the purpose of drawing a line between such as we think were ordained to govern and such as were made to bear the weight of government without having any share in its administration. To submit to our friends in the first class for their inspection the following defense of our monarchical aristocratical democracy." That was the first paragraph. Any comments on that first paragraph, guys?
No, it's good satire. Is this Brutus Jr.?
Nope. Okay. I'm not going to tell you who it is till I'm finished. I can't tell you who it is, but pseudonym they use, or nom de plume, I guess. And the first he says, as a majority of all societies consist of men, though totally incapable of thinking or acting in governmental matters, are more readily led than driven. We have thought meet to indulge them in something like a democracy in the new Constitution, which part we have designated by the popular name of the House of Representatives. But to guard against every possible danger from this lower house, we have subjected every bill they bring forward to the double negative of our upper house and president. Nor have we allowed the populace the right to elect their representatives annually, lest this body should be too much under the influence and control of their constituents, and thereby prove the weatherboard of our grand edifice to show the shiftings of every fashionable gale, for we have not yet to learn that little else is wanting to aristocratize the most democratical representative than to make him somewhat independent of his political creators. We have taken away that rotation of appointment, which has so long perplexed us, that grand engine of popular influence. Every man is eligible into our government from time to time for life. This will have a twofold good effect. First, it prevents the representatives from mixing with the lower class and imbibing their foolish sentiments with which they would have come charged on re-election. Any thoughts, Dave?
This is great satire. Really good.
Well, you know, he nails it. He said, you know, here, every man is eligible into our government from time to time for life. Now, how long has Joe Biden been in government?
I think he said 120 years the other day. No, but he actually did say that. But I think it's been, going on 50 years, man.
Yes, he's almost at a half a century. And so much, this would have been totally a person like Biden, a person like, you know, the idiot Pelosi from California, Mitch McConnell, you know, touching on both parties. All of this would have been completely impossible under the Articles of Confederation. Never could have happened. Number one, under the Articles of Confederation, we did not have a king. Oh, excuse me, president. That was an intentional slip because, as Patrick Henry said, away with your president. He will be a king. And Patrick Henry nailed it because now the very majority, I mean, stop and think. I was in a discussion the other day. Where in the Constitution is provided the power, as weak as it is, where in the Constitution is given the power for the president to shut down a enterprise like the Keystone Pipeline? Where is that provision in the Constitution? It doesn't exist. Where is the provision for presidents to rule by executive order? Doesn't exist. Where in the Constitution is the Supreme Court the final arbiter over the other two branches of government? Doesn't exist. None of this was possible under the Articles of Confederation because, number two, not only did the Articles of Confederation not have an executive, but the Articles of Confederation did not have a federal court system. Why do we need a duplication of courts? Why, when the people of our state, our peers, when they make a decision, why should some people thousands of miles away from where we live get to change that decision? What about a federal judge makes them more knowledgeable than a state judge? And why do we need the cost of the duplicity? Why do we need a judge sitting to make decisions and then another judge to make a decision and then one on the federal level to make a decision? Why do we have to pay all of these entities to make a legal decision? And if they have a difference of what is and what is not a constitutional issue, who is the arbiter to decide which of them is right? You know, look at the great Sanford case in 1857. The one where the state of Missouri had said Dred Scott was free. He was not a slave. And 11 years later, the federal court said, the Supreme Court said, yes, he is. Which one was constitutional? That, again, is just absolutely amazing. But I'm jumping now to this, going back to this anti-federalist. And his second point, he says, they will, from the perpetuality of office, be under our eye, and in a short time will think and act like us, independently of popular whims and prejudices. For the assertion that evil communications corrupt good manners is not more true than its reverse. We have allowed this House the power to impeach. He's talking about the Senate. But we have tenaciously reserved the right to try. We hope, gentlemen, you will see the policy of this clause for what matters, it who accuses, if the accused is tried by his friends. In time, this plebeian House will have little power, and that little be right, and that little be rightfully shaped by our House of Gentlemen, talking about the Senate overriding the House of Representatives, who will have a very extensive influence from their being chosen out of the genteel, wealthy, well-born class. It is true that every third senatorial seat is to be vacated due annually. But two-thirds of this influential body will remain in office and be ready to direct, if necessary, to bring over to the good old way the young new members, if the old ones should not be returned. And whereas many of our brethren, from a laudable desire to support their rank in life above the commonalty, have not only deranged their finances, but subjected their persons to indecent treatment, as being arrested for debt, etc. We have framed a privilege clause by which they may laugh at the fools who trusted them. But we have given out that this clause was provided only that the members might be able, without interruption, to deliberate on the important business of their country. That's the end of their paragraph. Any thoughts, Cal?
No, He's satirically explaining exactly what's being created, or and what was created.
You know, the problem today, Cal and Dave, what do you think, what I'm reading, do you think that the common, ordinary boobus today would understand what he's saying in any respect?
I couldn't answer that because I have no idea what Bubas understands anymore.
Well, Bubas doesn't know what he understands. That's obvious from the people we engage from time to time.
Yeah.
Well, I will continue with this, but I'm going to tell you this. He didn't write under his normal name, but from my years and years and years of research, Cal and Dave, I actually believe that this was written by Samuel Bryant. Because knowing his knowledge and knowing his reading his stuff and knowing his wit and his ability, I believe this has Samuel Bryant's stamp all over it, although it was written under the nom de plume of Montezuma. And now, go ahead.
Samuel Bryant or, you know, even Patrick Henry had that kind of sarcastic wit to them. The only other one I could see that would be like that would have been Thomas Tudor Tucker.
Yeah, he would have.
He had that. So, you know, we don't know exactly who it is, but I would concur with you that the most likely candidate would be Samuel Bryant.
Either that or his father, George Bryant.
or that, yes, true.
Yeah, one of those two. That to me is just yeah, you're exactly right, Cal, with the ability. The only thing I have found, one of the reasons I would discount Patrick Henry, is most of Patrick Henry's was oratory. Very little writings of Patrick Henry exist to be found, except in his letters.
Yeah.
And I never saw him assume this satirical air in his letters. Not to say that it's not the possibility, because certainly the intelligence and the opposition that he gave to the Constitution can be found in the writings here. But Dave, were you? Did you have a comment there, sir?
Well, yeah, Mike, maybe you could explain a little bit about Samuel Bryant just briefly to the audience and why you think that was him.
Well, Samuel Bryant wrote as Sentinel. And no one, you know, his first 1 through 18 of his 24 articles, Samuel Bryan just disassembled the Federalist and just exposed everything, including their financial fraud. And he was the only anti-Federalist that I can find that exposed the financial fraud of the Federalists. But 1 through 18 was about all of the things he found wrong with the Constitution. And 19 through 24, or basically 18 through, you could say 18 through 24, was about the election and trying to get people in to support a Bill of Rights. Well, then he wrote 69 more essays on a Bill of Rights. And I would challenge anyone to find those 69 essays. And then I will also point out that Samuel Bryan's 24 essays are available today at Amazon for $930. 212 pages, $930. Now, I can absolutely assure you that Bubas is not going to go pay $930 to read about someone he's never heard of. And many of the people who would be interested to know what Samuel Bryan had to say are not going to pay $930 to find out. And you can find a few of Samuel Bryan's writings on the internet. A few, I said, not that many. So here is the point, and we go back to the federal government having giving professors money to write their version of history. Why are we hiding the criticisms of the first Constitution behind a absolutely ridiculous $930 charge for a 212-page paperback book? But Samuel Bryan was, his father was the chief judge in Pennsylvania. And also, a lot of people are not aware that the author, and he admitted this in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, that the author of the dissent of the minority in Pennsylvania to the Constitution was written also by Samuel Bryan. And to I don't know really, Dave, how to better explain who he was than probably the most prolific critic of the Constitution and a good, thorough explanation of why it was written. Cal, can you add anything to that description of Mr. Bryan?
No. If you read through it, he absolutely picks apart the Constitution, exposing all the flaws and all the frauds and all the secrecy. And I don't know if people read what Sentinel wrote, I doubt people would have this strange affliction for these words on parchment.
Well, how else, Cal, could you describe why that a 212-page paperback book, which is not by in any ways, means, or shape, an antique collectible book, why would that the price of that book be $930?
To keep the truth out of the people's minds, to make it difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. You would have the people who could say, well, you know, it's available. You know, you just got to pay for it, but it's available, knowing full well that they have priced it out of the range of even people who would like to read it, the majority of people who would like to read it.
Yeah, exactly, Mike. You know, there's another example of what you're talking about. Frank Vanderlip, the guy that one of the guys that went to the secretive meetings in Jekyll Island, in his autobiography, Farm Boy to Financier, he admits, you know, this whole scheme of secrecy to going to Jekyll Island and proving that there really was a conspiracy to cook up the Federal Reserve System. Anyway, that book, if you try to buy it online, $650.
Well, you know, and then like that was obviously for the same reason. It's priced that way for the same reason. You know, also you have books that I'm seeing that are disappearing that you can't find anywhere anymore that were written in the 20s and 30s, which was probably 1950 was probably the last time that you could have picked up a really good historical accounting of the Constitutional Convention that was accurate. And probably the last great author was Merrill Jensen. And recently, this became quite hilarious and a point of discussion among myself and my friends and my wife, I found out that Merrill Jensen in 1936 gave a presentation at what is now Pacific University on the Articles of Confederation. And the title of his presentation was The Articles of Confederation Reconsidered. So I found out that this was like 26 pages of this presentation that he gave in California in 36. And I found that it did exist, that people did have it, and some people had it in PDF form. And so I said, well, you know, I'll call up. I'll get a copy of this because I'm really interested in reading this because, again, Jensen probably was the last person who really told the truth about the Constitutional Convention. So and the Articles of Confederation. So I started looking for that, and I went to several sources that said they had it and even called one on the phone, and they said, yes, we have it in PDF. And I said, well, I'd be happy to pay for it. And they said, sorry, it's not available. So one of my friends who's been on our show before, Mike Clifford up in Northwest Arkansas, he said, look, I've got several friends who are retired professors from the University of Arkansas. Let me see if they can get it through their connections. So he gets back with me in about 8 to 10 days. And he said, Mike, I'm sorry. He said, these professors tried. They can't get it. And it's like, okay, people, why would you have this, and why would you try to keep it out of the hands of the people at any price? I called one place that said they had it and offered to pay for it, and they told me I couldn't have it. But
what's the author's name again, Mike?
Merrill Jensen.
Okay.
Now, he wrote a book on the Articles of Confederation, which is very, very good, very well researched. The thing you will find about Merrill Jensen when you read his work is that you will have a page of text and about a half a page of footnotes. He footnoted the dickens out of stuff, and which I like because he's showing you sources of his what he's writing. He's not putting out opinion. He's putting out what is happening through sources. And I think that is fantastic. That's one of the reasons I like Merrill Jensen. But I finally got my hands on that dissertation and that speech by Merrill Jensen in 1936. I'm not going to reveal how I did it, but I was able to find it. And Cal, I'm going to, as soon as I get it into a PDF form of my own, because the PDF form I got when I tried to transfer it to Mike Clifford, he said that the only thing that would come up was the first page. The rest of it was blank. So I quickly printed out several copies and I'm making my own PDF of that document, that presentation, and I'll be forwarding it to both you and Dave, Cal, as soon as I finish that PDF.
Oh, please do. I'd really like to read that.
Awesome.
Yeah, you know, I just tried to search that on the internet, and I found one site that said it had it in PDF form. You click on it, it says, oh, can't be found.
Yeah, imagine that.
Dave, you'd be amazed at how many sites that you could source just a couple years ago. I mean, you could get a huge collection of Annie Federal's writings off this website called Teaching American History.
Yeah.
They're gone. Yes. They've removed them. They're gone. You get one or two of Sentinel, a couple from Brutus. That's it. They're gone. And it used to be, you could click on it and you could read them through in chronological order from when they were written. So they kind of made sense. It was fascinating. I was 3/4 of the way through it when it all disappeared. And unfortunately, I didn't save any of it.
All right. Well, it looks like we're coming up on the break here shortly. So we will get back to the writings of Montezuma or possibly Samuel Bryan, because I love this article. And then, Cal, I want you to go into some depth on the flip side about Patrick Henry, the things that Patrick Henry said that you really think are most significant. All right, folks, see you on the other side. Thank you so very much.
Came and unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
If you think convinced that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, here we are back with hour two of Dare to Think Out Loud. And my admonition is dare to think. I don't care if you do it out loud or not. I would prefer out loud, but at least just try to give thinking a chance instead of feeling. And I would remind you of a very old quote, but it is very, very good. And that is emotion without reason is Satan's playground. So our friend Dave had to step away for a couple of minutes. And Cal, we will carry on as if he was here with us until he gets back. I'm going to read another paragraph from Montezuma here, and then I'm really looking forward to seeing what you feel are your favorite points from Patrick Henry. But back to Montezuma. And that is, we have frequently endeavored to effect in our respective states the happy discrimination which pervades this system. But finding we could not bring the states into it individually, we have determined and have taken pains to leave the legislature of each free and independent state, as they now call themselves, in such a situation that they will eventually be absorbed by our grand continental vortex, or dwindle into petty corporations and have power over little else than yoking hogs or determining the width of cart wheels. But aware that an intention to annihilate state legislatures would be objected to our scheme, our favorite scheme, we have made their existence as a board of electors necessary to ours. This furnishes us and our advocates with a fine answer to any clamors that may be raised on this subject. We have so interwoven continental and state legislatures that they cannot exist separately. Whereas we, in truth, only leave them the power of electing us. For what can a provincial legislature do when we possess the exclusive regulation of external and internal commerce, excise, duties, imposts, post offices, and roads? When we and we alone have the power to wage war, make peace, coin money, if not borrow money, organize the militia, and call them forth to execute our decrees and to crush insurrections assisted by a noble body of veterans subject to our nod, which we have the power of raising and keeping even in the time of peace. What have we to fear from state legislators or even from states when we are armed with such powers, with a president at our head, a name we thought proper to adopt in conformity to the prejudices of a silly people who are so foolishly fond of Republican government that we were obliged to accommodate them in names and forms to them in order more effectually to secure the substance of our proposed plan. But we all know that Cromwell was a king with the title of protector. I repeat it. What have we to fear armed with such powers, with a president at our head who is captain general of the Army, Navy, and militia of the United States, who can make and unmake treaties, appoint and commission ambassadors and other ministers, who can grant or refuse reprieves or pardons, who can make judges of the Supreme and other continental courts? In short, who will be the source, the fountain of honor, profit, and power, whose influence, like the rays of the sun, will diffuse itself far and wide, will exhale all democratical vapors, and break the clouds of popular insurrection? But again, gentlemen, our judicial power is a strong work, a masked battery. Few people see the guns we can and will ere long play off from it. From the judicial power embraces every question which can arise in law or equity under this Constitution and under the laws of the United States, which laws will be, you know, the supreme laws of the land. This power extends to all cases affecting ambassadors and other public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state, claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens, or subjects. Wow. What do you think of that paragraph, Cal?
That could have been written today as well and been as accurate as it was way back then.
That is the point that I have tried to get across to people, Cal. You are so receptive of these ideas, that these things that the Federalists said, and you have to, and I did, I wrote an article one time, the Anti-Federalists, how did they know? But all you got to do is read that paragraph. And there is so much knowledge in that paragraph that what they did, you know, they took over the states. They made nothing out of the states. And what was it James Madison wrote to Edmund Randolph, Cal? Before the convention?
To make the states subordinately useful.
To allow them to exist where they were only subordinately useful. And yeah, Yes. No, I wasn't correcting you. I was going to another passage that he also wrote with the same thought.
Yeah.
Well Mike, you know, what really struck me with that paragraph was this idea. You said that the setting up a system where the states are not able to function alone. That is so significant. And that's exactly what they've done. And they've, you know, if you fast forward to today, look how they've completed that work.
Well, exactly. How did Samuel Bryan or whoever wrote this, how did they know that this is where it was going? You know, and especially, of course, we have all of these charlatans out there with their DVDs and their books and everything else and their presentations that they charge for, telling people over and over and over again that what the Federalists wrote was true. All of the marketing, all of the campaign, all of this stuff, this is actually what your Constitution is supposed to be, and they totally ignore what the Anti-Federalists said your Constitution will be. And my good friend Cal there has had some wonderful arguments. Well, I won't call them arguments, discussions with some of these charlatans on the on Facebook. And I appreciate Cal. That that is quite an endeavor. You've done one hell of a job, buddy.
Thank you. I, Mike, can I just point out that, you know, everybody looks to the Federalist Papers as the authority on this. Do people understand that the Federalist Papers, those letters written by Jay Hamilton and Madison, were in response to the concerns brought up by people like Henry and Bryan and Luther Martin and others?
Right.
And, they were a response, they're lies. And another point is how could Montezuma see what was happening or what was going to happen, and people today, while it's happening, still can't see it? I don't get it.
He's
describing exactly what's going on, and people still cannot see it, even though it's physically happening to them.
Now, someone 234 years ago predicts something, and it's happening today. Cal, that's such a beautiful point. And it's happening today, and the people it's happening to can't see it. That is, and let's go back just as my greatest illustration of the lies of the, and they are numerous, but the lies of the Federalist has to be James Madison in Federalist 45, where he says the powers of the federal government will be few and defined, and the powers of the state will be unlimited, and whatever the other phrase he used, I can't remember right now. But who was lying, James Madison or the Montezuma? That is the part that just, you know, and how he talks about how they would, how they were using words, how they couldn't say how they couldn't say monarch or king, so they said president. Well, you know, what is it Shakespeare said? A rose by any other name is still a rose. You know, the president, you can call him president all you want to. People have said, we don't have a king, we have a president. Well, the hell you say? Tell me that Biden isn't acting like a king. Tell me that Trump didn't act like a king. And the ones before them, Obama, Bush, they all acted like kings. They did not in any way, shape, form, or fashion adhere to the principles of Article 2 of the Constitution. And now I'm going to throw one more paragraph at you and from Montezuma, and this one is just beautiful, about the courts. And then, Cal, if you would be ready with your favorite Patrick Henry quotes. I'll start off this last paragraph here. It might not be the last paragraph of Montezuma, it'll be the last one I'll read because I want to get Cal into Patrick Henry here. And now from Montezuma again, he says, now, can a question arise in the colonial courts which the ingenuity or sophistry of an able lawyer may not bring within one or other of the above cases? Certainly not. Then our court will have original or appellate jurisdiction in all cases, and if so, how fallen are state judiciaries, and must not every provincial law yield to our supreme fiat? Our Constitution answers yes. And finally, we shall entrench ourselves so as to laugh at the cabals of the commonality. I would say Roe v. Wade right there is a great example. A few regiments will do at first. It must be spread abroad that they are absolutely necessary to defend our frontiers. Now, a regiment and then a legion must be added quietly. By and by, a frigate or two must be built, and still taking care to intimate that they are essential to the support of our revenue laws and to prevent smuggling. We have said nothing about a Bill of Rights, for we viewed it as an eternal clog upon our designs. People, let me say that again, because the Constitutional Convention voted down a Bill of Rights unanimously by state. Let me read what Montezuma said again. we have said nothing about a Bill of Rights, for we viewed it, a Bill of Rights, as an external clog upon our designs, as a lock chain to the wheels of government. Though, by the way, as we have not insisted on rotation in our offices, the simile of a wheel is ill. We have for some time considered the freedom of the press as a great evil. It spreads information and begets a licentiousness in the people which needs the rein more than the spur. Besides, a daring printer may expose the plans of government and lessen the consequence of our president and Senate. For these and many other reasons, we have said nothing with respect to the right of the people to speak and publish their sentiments or about their palladiums of liberty and such stuff. We do not much like that sturdy privilege of the people, the right to demand the writ of habeas corpus. We have therefore reserved the power of refusing it in cases of rebellion. And you know we are the judges of what is rebellion. Our friends, we find, have been assiduous in representing our federal calamities until at length the people at large, frightened by the gloomy picture on one side and allured by the prophecies of some of our fanciful and visionary adherents on the other, are ready to accept and confirm our proposed government without the delay or forms of examination, which was the more to be wished as they are wholly unfit to investigate the principles or pronounce on the merit of so exquisite a system. Impressed with a conviction that this Constitution is calculated to restrain the influence and power of the lower class, to draw that discrimination we have so long sought after, to secure to our friends privileges and offices which were not to be obtained under the former government because they were in common, to take the burden of legislation and attendance on public business off of the commonality, who will be much better able thereby to prosecute with effect their private business, to destroy that political 13-headed monster, the state sovereignties, to check the licentiousness of the people by making it dangerous to speak or publish daring or tumultuary sentiments, to enforce obedience to laws by a strong executive aided by military pensioners, and finally, to promote the public and private interest of the better kind of people, we submit it to your judgment to make such measures for its adoption as you in your wisdom may think fit. What do you think of that, guys?
That would be fun to go back through and comment like line by line on that last paragraph. You can expand on almost every sentence in there.
Oh, that is, you know, Cal, and you, I know you've done your exhaustive research as well. How many writings of the Anti-Federalists could you do that with?
Most of them. I mean, there's a line in there that shows that it was, you know, it was probably Samuel Bryan or his father who wrote that, because the comment about how quickly they wanted to affirm the new Constitution is mentioned in that, which was done in Pennsylvania. So well, it was a Pennsylvania. Did that appear in a Pennsylvania newspaper?
Well, that was what I was just going to comment on, and that is why I thought it was Samuel Bryan, because it was published by the same places that his essays were published, and it was published in the Independent Gazetteer in Philadelphia.
What's interesting too, Mike, is it really gives insight into how much the Bill of Rights was reviled by the Federalists. They really did not want that because they saw it as a threat to their power. It says a lot about their mindset.
Absolutely, but try to get your charlatans who are running around making speeches and making DVDs, which they sell to the Christian community, about how wonderful the Constitution is. Try to get them to admit this.
The Constitution was not written to secure people's liberty.
No, it was exactly the opposite. It, just as Montezuma says, the Constitution was written to limit the people's freedom.
Yeah.
It was, and they, and Montezuma lays it out so beautifully in this writing. This, to me, is one of the one of my absolute favorites. You know, and that's hard for me to say anything over Sentinel or Brutus, but my goodness, that in itself is probably, I think, one of the better pieces out there, since it really does the satire and takes it to the point of what actually, in reality, what the Federalists were actually thinking as they put this together. And that is why I think it took the brilliance of Samuel Bryan to do that. And, you know, Cal, you touched on something, and Dave, you've mentioned it before. I really believe that a person could take one of these, just one, any, just pick one, an anti-federalist paper, and I believe you could do a two-hour show on it, a two-hour program, doing exactly as Cal had said, if you just parsed it, took it sentence by sentence, and compared it with the tyranny and the despotism that we are experiencing today, and then asked that simple question, how did this person, sitting down with a quill and parchment paper, how did, you know, which happened to be made from hemp, how did these people know 234 years ago, how did they, or 35 years, or whatever the number of years, better than two centuries, how did they know what this was going to become?
Well, you know, Mike, I think my guess on that is that they understood human nature and what happens to human beings when they gain too much power. I think the outcome is always going to be the same. Human beings haven't changed that much since the dawn of time.
Wow.
They were well studied in the science of politics.
Yeah.
They understood. They had studied the classic civilizations, Rome and Greece and the others. They understood how all this worked. I mean, if you go back and trace it, you can trace all this, a lot of what's happening today throughout history, happening at other points in history. Well, as they say, you know, if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Well, stop and think about what he said about how they would gradually, while no one was paying attention, establish this huge military machine. I thought that was very telling as well. How, you know, we'll add a few here, and always under the claim of necessity. You know, we need that to protect this. We need that to protect this. And that's exactly the same thing they use now to go to war. Oh, yeah, well, so-and-so might do something. So let's go over there and kill them. I tell you what, try to implement that policy in your neighborhood. Try to say, well, you know, those people that live down there on the corner, one time he got caught for robbing a house, and he might actually do that again. So I'm going to go down there and kill him and his family. That's the American attitude about foreign countries. They might do something. Let's go kill them all. And the conservative element in America, especially the Christian conservative element, cheers that. Puts it on their church marquees. Support the troops while they're out there committing crimes. Yeah, okay. Well, I'll stop on that one because we're about to get away from the subject matter here. Cal, launch us into Mr. Patrick Henry, please, sir.
Oh, real quick before I do that, it was always often stated by the men back then that a standing military, or especially in a time of peace, was the bane of all liberty. That was back then. Today, they celebrate that bane of liberty. The people actually celebrate what the people they supposedly revere considered the bane of liberty. It just, the irony and contradiction is just so stark, it blows me away.
Well, I think the thing that I noticed years ago, guys, was that every time in these writings, almost every time, I don't want to be, broad brush, but almost every time a discussion came up among the anti-federalists about what we call today our Second Amendment, almost every time it came about in the context of we needed to be armed in order to protect ourselves from a standing military, a standing army. The people need to be protected. They had just undergone how did King George inflict his despotism on the people of the 13 colonies? With his standing army. And the people back then were bright enough to know that if one government will do it, they will all do it. The anti-federalists had no illusions that if you gave, as they referred to it, if you give the power of the purse and the sword to the same government, you're in trouble. And they were exactly right. And one of the anti-federalists, I'm trying to think of it now, which one actually said that the problem of unlimited taxation was that the government would use the power of unlimited taxation to form an army that the people could not refuse. So you're paying for your own enslavement. Okay, Cal, whenever you're ready, buddy, jump into your favorite Patrick Henry passages.
My favorite, most favorite Patrick Henry passage would have to be, came about on June 5th at the Ratification Convention, where he said, "You are not to inquire how your trade may be increased, nor how you are to become a great and powerful people, but how your liberties can be secured. For liberty ought to be the direct end of your government." What seems to have been lost throughout the generation since then is that the focus is on liberty, not on country, not on flag, not on trade. These are all part of it, but the common denominator is to be the liberty of the people. And when you keep the common denominator as the liberty of the people, you have peace and prosperity. You don't have a government oppressing you or other people oppressing you. It's just how liberty works. That's one of the blessings of liberty. It's just once the wordsmiths have gotten people to conflate their constitution with their liberty, they conflate their country with their liberty. I mean, what is it you want? You want liberty and no country, or country and no liberty? If it came down to that choice, what would you choose? And so that one boils it all down to me that it's about liberty, or as Thomas Jefferson, my second favorite, once put, rightful liberty. So that's my most favorite quote from Patrick Henry.
Well, what about read for the folks, please, Cal, or repeat from memory. I'm pretty sure you have it memorized. What did Thomas Jefferson define as rightful liberty?
Rightful liberty is the unobstructed action according to our will within the limits drawn around us by the equal rights, rightful liberty. I'm doing this off my top of my head. Rightful liberty is the unopposed action according to our will within the limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. And I do not add within law, because law is often but the tyrant's will, and always so when it violates the rights of the individual.
I thought you had that memorized, buddy.
Yeah, that became one of my favorite quotes that I memorized a long time ago. Yeah, that speaks volumes. I mean, if people would just put these maxims as their priority, it's just priority, folks. This is the priority, is liberty. It's not a strong country, because if you have liberty, you'll have a strong country. Because, you know, we're all armed. Who's going to invade us? And the right to be armed is part of my liberty. It's the right to self-defense. No, I don't understand how people don't get this. And, you know, I mean, in our liberty, I mean, it's said, given to us by our Creator, and everybody's saying, well, there needs to be this divine intervention to correct all the maladies going on. Well, it's right there. It's always been right there. It was put there since the beginning of man because man has always had rightful liberty. It's part of the birthright of being born human. I boil it down to that. And so everything else is just kind of, you know, off in the weeds for me anymore.
Well, I thought, and you bring up so many good points, and when you mentioned that part about liberty and the people being armed, I go back to the history of World War II and the fact that there were people in the emperor's cabinet, if you want to call it that, in Japan, who urged a full-fledged attack on the west coast of the United States in harmony with the attack on Pearl Harbor. And that was discussed in their war councils. But the emperor, and I think Hirohito even said that, no, we do not want to attack the mainland of North America, because the people are armed and there would be a person with a gun behind every blade of grass.
That was actually Yamamoto who said that. Okay, and he said Yamamoto, that because he studied, he actually went to school in the United States. So he had personal experience of being in the United States prior to the war.
Right.
So he knew firsthand, you're not going to get away with invading this country because the people will view you as an enemy and treat you as such. And they are all armed. That is the largest army in the world, people. An armed populace.
Exactly. Stop and think about, I don't know how many people we have in the military today, but how would that military stand up against a country of 300 million armed citizens? I don't think anybody would want to go up against 300 million armed citizens. But going back to Patrick Henry and back to the theme, you mentioned June the 5th, and that is one of my favorites too, Cal, but I really like how Patrick Henry opened and the accusations he made on June the 4th, his opening presentation. And I love these words, which I made reference to before. And Patrick Henry said, "I consider myself as the servant of the people of this Commonwealth, as a sentinel over their rights, liberty, and happiness. I represent their feelings when I say that they are exceedingly uneasy at being brought from that state of full security, which they enjoyed, to the present delusive appearance of things." So he's talking about the security that the people held under the Articles of Confederation, and the fact that they were losing that state of full security under the new Constitution. And I said that with that, we find the true difference in Patrick Henry, his fellow anti-federalists, and those with whom history has bequeathed the name Federalist. From his words, Henry considered himself not the master of the people of Virginia, but their servant. And more importantly, he saw himself as the sentinel or protector, if you will, of their rights, liberty, and happiness. Now, look at the difference today. It's flipped on its ear, because today the government is the master of the people, and the people are not the masters of their own government. And I said, whereas the Federalists saw themselves as the masters and controllers of the people and their property. So, and to prove that, I added this. And that was the words of George Washington and Gouverneur Morris. And here's a quote. "Experience hath taught us that men will not adopt and carry into execution measures the best calculated for their own good without the intervention of a coercive power. And Congress have too frequently made use of the suppliant, humble tone of requisition in applications to the states when they had a right to assume their imperial dignity and to command obedience. I promise you today that the Congress and the President and the judges of the United States feel exactly as Washington did back then, and they feel they have a right to assume their imperial dignity and command obedience to their laws or rules or whatever they want to. And Gouverneur Morris said at the Constitutional Convention, he said, "This country must be united. If persuasion does not unite it, the sword will." Now, does that sound like consent of the governed? And those were the Federalists. Those were the ones that people look to today saying, oh, you know, the wonderful Federalists, let's read what they wrote. This was what these Federalists believed. But here is something that I thought was very, very relevant on the 4th with the Virginia Ratification Convention. And the Virginia Ratification Convention took place in June of 1788. And during the midst of the June Ratification Convention, New Hampshire ratified, which made it the 9th state. But people were still terribly concerned about Virginia because Virginia contained so much of the wealth and so much of the population of the entire country and its influence. They were so afraid that if Virginia failed to ratify, New York, which had scheduled right after, would also fail to ratify. And they knew, even with 9 states ratifying the Constitution, if Virginia and New York held out ratification, they were in trouble. And so they were so worried about the Virginia Ratification Convention. And here, I think, is one of the most telling parts of that convention. The convention, according to the order of the day, resolved itself into the committee of a whole of the whole to take into consideration the proposed plan of government. Now, George Wythe was the chair. And he started out, and the first person to speak was Patrick Henry. And he made a motion. And he said his motion was that the act of assembly appointing deputies to meet at Annapolis to consult with those from some other states on the situation of the commerce of the United States, the act of assembling appointing deputies to meet at Philadelphia to revise the Articles of Confederation, and other public papers relative thereto should be read. Now, I can imagine when Patrick Henry made this motion that there was a big pucker factor taking place. Because if all of these documents that he just requested, the assembly appointing the people to meet at the Annapolis Convention the year previous, the act of the assembly appointing the people, the delegates to the Philadelphia Convention to revise the Articles of Confederation, and any papers relative thereto to be openly read, Patrick Henry knew that if he could accomplish that, he would expose the Federalists and their plans in their own words. And he knew it. And as I wrote, and back then, I said, the Federalists must have frozen in their shoes at this motion. Had all these Federalist machinations to form a new government been made public at this time, the very idea of ratification may have been blown completely out of the water. But immediately, passionate Federalist Edmund Pendleton, who repeatedly clashed with Patrick Henry over his stance on the Stamp Act and other issues with England, he considered to be divisive, and who had previously referred to Patrick Henry as a demagogue, and at the Virginia House of Burgesses, he called him a traitor. He made a completely absurd yet very revealing objection to Patrick Henry's motion. And he said, and this is just amazing, "Mr. Chairman, we are not here to consider whether the Federal Convention exceeded their powers. It strikes my mind that this ought not to influence our deliberations." What? Patrick Henry on the opening of the opening day of the convention, the very opening of the convention, was about to show the conspiracy of which Samuel Bryan wrote about, the whole thing being a conspiracy. Patrick Henry was about to expose that. And Pendleton said openly, let me read that again, "Mr. Chairman, we are not here to consider whether the Federal Convention exceeded their powers." What? "It strikes my mind that this ought not to influence our deliberations." And then he went on to say, "I did not expect these papers would have been brought forth, although those gentlemen were only directed to consider the defects of the old system and not to devise a new one." What? He admitted again that they violated the very Constitution that had sent them to Philadelphia. He admits it. It's in writing. They admitted they perpetrated a fraud on the people. They admitted they broke the laws of the Constitution they were operating under. Now, Cal, had you ever, were you aware of that before?
Yeah, recently, but that was through you recently.
So here,
I learned it, but you taught it to me. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
You brought that out. Yeah. No, so, thank you.
So here, the Federalist, as voiced by Edmund Pendleton, stated that it was irrelevant as to whether they had acted unconstitutionally or illegally in forming the new Constitution, and such crimes as they had committed ought not to influence the convention in its decision-making process of ratification. And as I said before, Pendleton admits that they were sent to Philadelphia with one purpose: to consider the defects in the old system and to amend the Articles of Confederation to deal with that. They were in no way were they authorized to write a new constitution. And as Samuel Bryan, good old Sentinel, would write later, they were engaged in a criminal conspiracy. That is irrefutable. Dave, you still with us?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Excellent, Mike.
So what are your thoughts on that? Can you create a valid document with a criminal act?
No, absolutely not. And it's just, you know, I think most people are completely unaware of the secrecy surrounding the Constitution and this 50-year agreement that they all made. None of that's taught in history class. And whenever you have a document surrounded in secrecy, you know there's something rotten in Denmark, so to speak.
Well, I went on in my article when I wrote about this. I said Edmund Pendleton would here make the case that if his crime was ratified by a majority of the delegates and eventually the states, it would take on the mantle of legality. Really? How many people does it take to condone child molestation, murder or treason for it to be declared legal? So can a valid constitution be created by a totally unconstitutional act? But the crazy thing about this convention, and that was, but for some never disclosed reason that I can find anywhere, after Edmund Pendleton's objection to Patrick Henry's motion, there was no further discussion. What happened? And I will go on to say that during the 20 some days of that ratification convention, Randolph and Patrick Henry would become, their arguments would become so heated, in the words of several delegates, they thought there would be a duel between Patrick Henry and Edmund Randolph. Or Edmund Pendleton, I'm sorry, before the convention was over. They actually thought it would devolve to that act of a actual duel. So
why do you think that didn't happen?
I'm not sure. You know, reading everything possible that I can find on that ratification convention. And Cal, that's another point. Have you noticed how the daily minutia, all of the writings that were available through the Avalon Project a few years back on the Virginia Ratification Convention have disappeared?
Yeah, it's difficult to find all of that stuff anymore. I mean, you'll get bits and pieces of it, but the full text is missing. It's been edited, so to speak. Or redacted, would that be the redacted? That would be the more proper.
Yeah, I think that's a great term. But my question in my mind was, if we go by, you know, the rules of procedure, which they were pretty good about following, did Patrick Henry withdraw that motion? There's no record of it.
Well, Patrick Henry, being a lawyer, had just listened to one of the perpetrators in the crime confess. So I guess to him, it's up to the jury to decide now that he accused him of a conspiracy. Edmund Pendleton confessed to it, and it's up to the jury of the peers around him to decide. And well, apparently they didn't see it.
Well, the thing I was looking for was a continued debate on the motion. We have the motion. We have the objection by Randolph. So it would appear to me that had they debated the issue after Randolph said, yeah, well, it doesn't make any difference. If there had been a debate, the Federalist would have had to have justified why they did not want to reveal the record of their actions, reference the Annapolis Convention and the Philadelphia Convention. And afterwards, according to the documents that are available, Patrick Henry then said this. He said, "Mr. Chairman, the public mind, as well as my own, is extremely uneasy at the proposed change of government. Give me leave to form one of the numbers of those who wish to be thoroughly acquainted with the reasons of this perilous and uneasy situation and why we are brought hither to decide on this great national question. Before the meeting of the late Federal Convention at Philadelphia, a general peace and a universally tranquility prevailed in this country. But since that period, things are exceedingly uneasy and disquieted. When I wished for an appointment to this convention, my mind was extremely agitated for the situation of public affairs. I conceived the Republic to be in extreme danger. If our situation be thus uneasy, whence has arisen this fearful jeopardy? It arises from this fatal system. It arises from a proposal to change our government, a proposal that goes to the utter annihilation of the most solemn engagements of our states. I expect to hear the reasons for an event so unexpected to my mind and many others. Was our civil polity or public justice endangered or sapped? Was the real existence of the country threatened, or was this preceded by a mournful progression of events? This proposal of altering our federal government is of a most alarming nature. It will be necessary for this convention to have a faithful historical detail of the facts that preceded the session of the federal convention and the reasons that actuated its members in proposing an entire and complete alteration of government and to demonstrate the dangers that awaited us. If they were of such awful magnitude as to warrant a proposal so extremely perilous as this, I must assert that this convention has an absolute right to a thorough discovery of every circumstance relative to this great event. And here I would make this inquiry of those worthy characters who composed a part of the late federal convention. I am sure they were fully impressed with the necessity of forming a great consolidated government instead of a confederation. That this is a consolidated government is demonstrably clear, and the danger of such a government is, to my mind, very striking." Unquote. So Patrick pretty well nailed him to the wall, and that was on the first day. So what are your thoughts on that, Cal?
Well, I thought it's interesting that, heck, maybe even way back then, things were redacted clear back then. And in the heat of the debates and the discussions going on, it had slipped Patrick Henry's mind that none of this had taken place. I mean, being distracted, you know, almost to a duel with Edmund Randolph in his arguments, he might tend to forget that he'd brought that up, you know, just human nature, just looking at human nature and, wait a minute, I raised this up, but we still never finished addressing it type thing. It just, you know, as the days go on, you just kind of forget about those things, I guess. I don't know why it wasn't actually put there. And, you know, you've done a great job of pointing it out through forensic research of what the Federals were actually up to.
Well, Mike, what I find striking in that paragraph is he's sort of calling out in real time what was happening and what was going to happen. And if you just really sit back and contemplate what the man said, he really saw what was afoot. It's really quite incredible. It's very profound. Mike, you're muted.
Thanks, Dave. Operator error. My bad. But someone probably should, you know, just really do a deep detail of every day that Patrick Henry spoke, all 17 days out of 23. He spoke 17 days, one day for 7 hours. Now, stop and imagine today. Do you know anybody in government who has the kind of passion that they could speak for 7 hours on a subject with no notes or no teleprompter? Because I remember, you know, have we had a president in our recent lifetimes, going back to Kennedy, probably Kennedy Nixon, have we had anyone who could give a presentation without a teleprompter? And we know from history, if we are to believe Patrick Buchanan, that almost all of Richard Nixon's speeches were written by Patrick Buchanan. Do we, if someone has to have their speeches written by someone else, does anybody know what these people actually stand for? Or is someone just writing a speech for them for consumption to gullible Bubus Americanus?
Well, they've been reduced to essentially a salesman is what it comes down to, I think.
That goes all the way back to Hamilton writing the speeches for Washington.
Exactly. And most people are unaware of
that. The guy
who
ran the government back then, yeah. Hamilton.
Yeah, without a doubt. Well, guys, I tell you what, we're creeping up here. We've got 3 or 4 minutes left, according to my calculation, probably less. But, you know, to me, I thank you guys for coming along, because I think there is so much history in the Anti-Federalists that we just have never approached, never gone into, and especially that piece by Montezuma. Do you guys have that piece by Montezuma? Would you like me to forward it to you?
I would love it if you would.
Yeah, please do.
All right. I most certainly will. One of my favorites. And Cal, I still would like your thoughts after you read it through a few times. I would like your thoughts on my proposition that it was Samuel Bryan's work.
It definitely sounds like him just from you reading it. It's him or his father, both of those, you know. I mean, what Mike, for people that know that, Mike has read a god-awful lot more letters written between the founders than I have. But after reading them, you kind of get a feel for who they are, what they're saying, and their way of talking and verbiage with each other. So you kind of instinctively get a feel for who's doing the talking on someone like Montezuma. It just has that feel to it. It just, you get a kind of a commonality feeling towards, this is how this person thought, this is how they wrote. It's like, you know, Mike, you'd probably agree that Hamilton was a pompous asshole in his writings.
Amen.
I mean, to read some of Hamilton's stuff is, it makes your eyes bleed and your brain fall out of your head. It turns your brain to mush trying to understand what the heck he's trying to say. And his arrogance in him, it just, please don't make me read any more Federalists, because I cannot stand Hamilton.
Well, I agree with you totally.
You know, other than, you know, Federalist 43, where he admits that, yeah, we have unlimited taxation. It's necessary. Right. But this is what I don't get. He admits it in that Federalist 23. Yeah, it might be necessary to have unlimited taxation. So we gave him the power for that. People go around and say there's not unlimited taxation. Yeah. It's like, hell, even Hamilton agreed to it.
Yeah, that was the point that gets me about our charlatans like David Barton and Chris Ann Hall, who says, no, we do not have unlimited taxation. There's no such thing. And Hamilton admitted it himself. That is the part that just absolutely blows these people out of the water, in my opinion.
The honesty, I mean, you talked about the dishonesty of Madison in 45, where he says, you know, the powers are expressly and delegated. And, you know, he contradicts that himself on the floor of the House. But the truth spoken by the Federalists, I mean, you could take their own words and show exactly what they were up to.
It's over, and I am so sorry. Sorry to interrupt, Cal, but folks, thanks for tuning in, and we certainly look forward to seeing everyone next week. Have a fantastic weekend, please.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven. Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We talk about